We want to have a government and a country that's run on a higher ethical base, on a different level. What happened to it? I understand we're very defensive. We're fighting an ugly war against a terrible enemy. But every time an incident occurs, the response is we're not worse than somebody else because 10 years ago, the Americans did it in this, and 20 years ago, someone did it in that. But this driving, no, we're not measuring ourselves with as good or as bad as everybody else, which it's harder, but it should be our goal, right? Not to be not worse than everybody else.
I'm Scott Kahn, and this is the Orthodox Conundrum. This is a bonus episode of the Orthodox Conundrum on JewishCoffeeHouse.com. I'm Scott Kahn. In episode 201, Rabbi Alex Israel, citing Rav Kook, asked whether nowadays we need to add a greater prophetic element to Judaism alongside our continued commitment to halakha. Perhaps today we need a new infusion of prophecy, both in terms of its spiritual content, as well as through a renewed emphasis on Torah values that may sometimes be lost in standard halakhic discourse. In that episode, Rabbi Israel and I talked about the sad reality that some people feel that halakha alone does not satisfy their spiritual thirst, and we discussed the issue of potentially losing the forest of Torah values for the trees of the myriad details of Jewish law. How, in other words, shall we combine the necessity of including a living prophetic agenda within our commitment to fulfilling the details of halakhic practice? Rabbi Yosef Blau, the senior Mashgiach Ruchani at Yeshiva University, wrote to tell me that while he greatly respected Rabbi Israel's approach, he felt that there are some important caveats that need to be added to the discussion. With that in mind, I invited him back to the podcast to voice his specific concerns. We spoke about potential problems in the search for spirituality, the dangers of treating rabbis like prophets, and the difficulty in emphasizing Torah values and the fear that they can replace Jewish law. We also spoke extensively about the state of Israel and its current war against Hamas, including whether Israel is living up to its own stated goals of being a Medina Lemofet, that is, the world's exemplary nation. He mentioned a major flaw in secular Zionism and asked whether religious Zionism as a movement has at times de-emphasized what it considers Western morality in the service of other Torah values that it holds in higher regard. It was an important conversation, and whether you agree or disagree with Rabbi Blau, I'm sure that you will find his ideas both engaging and important. Rabbi Yosef Blau was appointed Mashgiach Ruchani, Spiritual Guidance Counselor, at Yeshiva University in 1977 and currently serves as its senior Mashgiach Ruchani. He's been involved in many educational and communal endeavors, including serving as National President of Yavne, as President of the Religious Zionists of America, and as Vice President of the National Conference of Yeshiva Principals. Rabbi Yosef Blau, thank you very much for joining me today on the Orthodox Conundrum podcast.
It's my pleasure to participate in what I think is a very important discussion.
Well, I appreciate that. After my interview with Rabbi Alex Israel, someone whom we both respect, you reached out to me to tell me that even though you found his ideas engaging and important, you felt that there also is another side to this concept of prophetic Judaism that should be discussed and to which people should be alerted. So I'll ask you to please outline what those potential problems are, the other side of the coin, if you will.
Okay. Before I respond, I just want to say, appreciate what Rabbi Israel has done by referring to the article by Rav Kook and noting some of the problems we have now under the present way we approach things. And that having a state and it shifts a great deal from the individual to the communal and sets a whole different standards of what kind of behavior is religiously significant. Having said that, my concerns start with the most obvious one is how do you have a prophetic Judaism without having a prophet?
Okay, what does that mean?
How do you know that with something that makes you feel good is necessarily an appropriate response, an authentically Jewish response? Let me start. I have a whole list of things. I want to start with this search for spirituality, which is very much in the news today in our community. And I want to start with describing a debate that I heard many years ago. I had gone to Israel to participate in that which was called then the Lavi Conference, called that because it was held in Kibbutz Lavi. And it was a gathering of religious Zionist thinkers. And I was really wanted to know what's going on more intellectually in Israel. So I wrote a paper so that I could get in, and I attended the conference. So at one particular session, the two panelists that I remember were the late Rav Shagar Zatzal and the Bar Chaim, Rav Meir HaKohen. Rabbi Shagar, in his presentation, said that one year was Yom Kippurim in his yeshiva, and the students couldn't get into it. It was too depressing. So he asked them what would help, and they said, "We made Yom Kippur more like Simchas Torah." And he said, "Okay." And they had a wonderful Yom Kippur, and they were inspired, and everything was great. And then when Rav Raimim HaKohen got up to speak, he said, "To me, it sounds like Avodah Zarah. You've turned Yom Kippurim, which has specific religious content, the Jewish concept of Yom Kippurim, and decided that which works for you or works for your students, that's what it becomes. Are you worshiping HaKadosh Baruch Hu or worshiping what appeals to you?" And I think that captures a serious part of this. Many of the things that are done in events promoting spirituality are not specifically Jewish. They could be done, when I used to attend events of NCSY, I would think, if I went to a Christian youth group, would they be doing a lot of the same things? And I suspect yes. And if it's Buddhist, of course, yes. So how do we ensure, one, that it's not superficial, and two, that it's authentically Jewish and without a prophet, put a stamp of approval on it?
So, Rabbi Blau, I wanted to comment on that one point. What you're saying now, please correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds a lot like what I've heard in the name of Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal, that he was very against the concept of a tekes, an empty tekes. For example, I believe an example might be, we're coming up soon on Yom HaAtzmaut, Bezrat Hashem, the idea of having a haftarah without a Torah reading,
Right.
sort of put in as what he would call a tekes. It's an empty ceremony because there's no concept of a haftarah on Yom HaAtzmaut if you don't have a Torah reading. What is this exactly? It sounds like you're describing something similar to that, that complaint about the concept of an empty ceremony that makes you feel good.
I'm very much influenced by Rav Soloveitchik, and I heard him speak about that very thing in a certain context when it came up. I don't want to get caught up in going over the past, all the stories from the past. Gotta save them for another time.
Okay.
Okay, now I want to talk about the other side of it. Noting that we don't have traditional prophets, establishing people, scholars, leaders, as semi-prophets. They'll give you the most significant example I can in Israel. Rav Kook's son gave a famous talk just a few weeks before the Six-Day War, which was seen by his followers as prophetic. Said, "Where we don't have this, we don't have Hebron, and we don't have, the old city." And he went on through all the parts of Israel we didn't have. And sure enough, a couple months later, we now have them. But once you've turned him into a prophet, you're paying a serious price, because now his authority is not based on either Torah analysis or logical reasoning. He's a prophet, so whatever he says is automatically true. And but we don't have prophets. We don't suddenly declare prophets. And it came to a head again at the time of the Hitnatkut.
Hitnatkut refers to the 2005 Israeli disengagement from the Gaza Strip when Israel removed all of its soldiers and civilians from Gaza.
I was in Neve Dekalim just a few days beforehand. I was in Israel at the time. I was part of a group who went down to Neve Dekalim. And the Rosh Yeshiva in the Yeshiva in the Beit HaKalim gave a talk, because it was in Hebrew. I was asked to translate it, so I remember it very well. He essentially said, based on a midrashic interpretation of some material in Sefer Shmuel Aleph about Shaul sending his representatives to the Bnei Nevi'im around Shmuel, and they turn, he guaranteed everybody in the room that the Israeli soldiers, when they came to invade the Kalim and they saw their commitment to Eretz Yisrael, they would join them. They wouldn't take them out of their homes. They would join them. And, well, it didn't happen, obviously. It caused a crisis that somehow got resolved in various ways. But these Rabbanim were functioning almost as Nevi'im, whose prophecies didn't happen, you know. So this can create a whole world which doesn't function the way we're, which I think is the appropriate way we function in dealing with issues. And it has become a dominant movement within the religious Zionist community in Israel. I'm not counting numbers, I don't know numbers. But certainly the political representation of religious Zionism at this time, sitting in the Knesset, in the cabinet, reflect this mentality. It's this certainty that the events going on with this terrible terrorist attack on Hamas and the war has messianic implications, and therefore they know exactly, we don't judge by military decisions, political decisions. We know what's supposed to happen, right? Because it's part of the messianic process. Again, without the old norms, halakh decisions are made on a certain basis. We can get into the discussion of whether the generals or the rabbis should decide. That's been going on for a long time. But there's a basis for this that is not messianic certitude, because we treat the rabbis as somewhat prophets.
Where it comes from, certainly in the Haredi world, and in more particularly in the Hasidish world, that's been something which has been happening for a long time. The concept of the Hasidic tzaddik, who the Rebbe, who will tell his followers, I mean, speaking a little bit exaggerated, but what color paint they should paint their house, and also tell them what's going to happen, and all sorts of things that are outside the realm of psak, is something which has invaded all of Orthodox Judaism, I think, not only the religious Zionist world.
You're absolutely correct. Right? You're absolutely correct. Rav Kook was a Rebbe, not a formally Hasidic Rebbe, even though he had a Hasidic, you know, in his ancestry, there was one side was Litvak and one side was Chabad. He did have a Hasidic background. But I'm referring now to dealing with a very specific thing and the extent of this. The Haredi world, which is a whole discussion in its own right, is simply removed itself from issues facing the broader Jewish world. You know, they're separatists. We live in our community and we follow our rabbis. You know, it doesn't deserve the determined policy for the Israeli government.
Let me ask you a question then, Rabbi Blau. I'm fully on board with what you're saying, and I'm also bothered by it. But to me, and I want to know if you agree with me or not about this, I'm asking what the problem is with that second aspect, with the looking at Gedolim as prophets. And I'll explain what I mean. If a Gadol, let's say someone like Rav Soloveitchik, I know his followers didn't look at him like that, but let's say they did, there's no real harm done, because ultimately whatever he was doing, he was saying based on psak and a deep and broad knowledge of Torah. The problem I have, and this is my question too, if I'm right or if you think I'm wrong about this, is less what people treat the Rebbe's as, more the way the Rebbe's or the Rav or whoever it is treats himself. He starts to believe his own PR, so to speak. Because if what he's doing is discovering what his followers call prophecy by looking in the text, well, that just means he's pasking al pi halacha. But if he's considering himself as having some deeper insight, that's when we get into problems. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that, but I want to focus on another aspect. And I get this question all the time. What would the Rav say about what's going on now. He's an authority, he's a public, whoever we're talking about. He responds to questions that are relevant at the time that the questions are asked, the circumstances and everything accordingly. If he's a prophet, then I can try to figure out what he would have said now also. I always answer people, I don't know what he would say now. I don't know how he would read the situation. That's, in general, I find the approach of saying, I know what Rav Kook would have said now. No, you don't know what Rav Kook would have said now. You know, he passed away 90 plus years ago. How do you know what he was going to? The reality has changed in so many ways. So that's why how you view someone, if you just go as a great posek, you're only paskin according to the reality that you're dealing with. But if you're a prophet, then it doesn't, nothing changes anything. And that's where I think it gets dangerous. I'm using a strong word. Okay, I have one more point.
Yes, please.
Okay. And this was one of the things that I found extremely important in Rabbi Israel's presentation. Torah values. We replace formal technical halacha with Torah values. The problem is that it's much harder to determine what we mean, what are important Torah values. Values are a bit more abstract term than you know, a shaila and halacha where a particular case is analyzed and a conclusion is drawn. And it just so happens that as a boy in yeshiva asked me, and we started learning a not well-known work by Rav Kook. It's almost never mentioned, but apparently it's been authenticated. Right? He wrote before he came to Israel, but a updated Moreh Nevuchim, a Moreh Nevuchim for our times. And it's a fascinating work, but I'm just interested in the first few chapters. Oh!
I'm holding up the Nebuchadnezzar right now for Rabbi Blau.
Okay. In which he talks about Torah values, right? The basic Torah values. And he describes it with two words. Yosher v'tzedek.
Uprightness and justice.
It's almost very close to what Hashem says about Avraham Avinu, right? Tzedakah u'mishpat. Now, these are clearly major Jewish values. I'm sorry to say, I don't see any evidence that in saying we should focus on Torah values, that the religious community is in any manner or form any better than anybody else in terms of striving for Yosher v'Tzedek. It's not on our agenda, you know. That is not on our agenda. But other things have become very much, you know, I understand you couldn't focus on Eretz Israel as a major part of Judaism when we're in Golos, because then it's talk. You know, that's all it is, it's talk. But coming back and having a state, the role that Eretz Israel plays in our thinking has obviously shifted. But how critical a Torah value is the land? And when it becomes defined to be the most critical Torah value, and that, to me, it's controversial. Controversial means that I don't agree. Right? And I see this again. Halacha is very well defined. The notion of translating values into actions seems a very fundamental Jewish concept. We're never, I mean, the Rav writes a great deal of it, but I don't think I have to turn to the Rav for this. You know, we talk about, you know, the Kiyum Shebelev, which is the famous phrase that the Rav has introduced into Brisk. But Kiyum Shebelev never means that there's no Masa HaMitzvah.
Internal fulfillment is not enough. There always has to be some action.
Not
as
enough.
Well.
It always has to be expressed in something behavioral. We have to do something, act upon it, because that's so fundamentally Jewish. And so let's allow for this, it's Rav Kook, not just Rabbi Israel. And it's very, it makes a lot of sense. After the Churban HaBayis, the Kadosh Baruch Hu only has the Dalai Lama Shel Halacha. The implication is when, before the Churban HaBayis, Kadosh Baruch Hu had more in this world, right? It wasn't only the Dalai Lama Shel Halacha. And the way Halacha has developed in Golos as being the focus of all of Judaism has been unquestionably a steady process of increased chumras becoming normative halacha.
More and more strict.
It is clear that despite all the talk about a Torah state would have, by to function at all, would have to take a totally different perspective. Certainly a Torah state with the majority of people not even observant. But even if we're all observant to function in a modern world, as a state would require a lot of kulos
Lovely Nancy's.
and a different way of looking at things. There's some very interesting articles that I just saw because the tradition is putting that online by Rabbi Abraham Stav, who's a young, a relatively young person. Obviously, the name Stav is familiar. Not only his father, the head of Tzohar, but his uncle happens to be in YU now, who was a Rebbe in Cambria for decades, beloved Rebbe. But he has this, he's been looking at being in the army now from a religious perspective, right? And seeing the army in different ways reflect different kinds of mitzvahs, different kinds of religious expression. It hasn't been fully explored yet, but clearly that's one of the things that has to be explored when we're talking about translating to a new state. So I appreciate the fact that this singular focus on minutia of halacha without a broader perspective is. Rav Kook's point is very well taken, not that Rav Kook needs my haskama. We live in a different time, a different agenda. It's also very hard, to translate to new terms, and we haven't done much. And interestingly, in medical and scientific ways, technological ways, we've done a lot. Even if a lot of it's technical, like the grammar switch, right? It's been, how do we figure this out? Technologically, but beyond technology and medicine, which is going to change anyway, in the nature of medicine. I remember reading an article a number of years ago, and it was a Rebbe in one of the as the yeshivas who wrote, basically, that was our initial project. We can't do it, so we'll get Mashiach. Mashiach will do it for us, which I'm not even sure. Certainly, according to Rambam, well, that's the function of Mashiach. Anyway, there's an awful lot to be done to translate this into reality. And that's why I think it's important to point out some of the pitfalls. I'm not saying we shouldn't try, but we should be aware of both sides of it.
Then let me ask you, Rabbi Blau, because one thing I'm confused about is how do we define Torah values? For example, you're talking about the idea of Yosher, Mishpat, Tzedek, these ethical values that come through. And I relate to that. That's something which I think is, it sounds right to me. But if someone were to say that Eretz Yisrael, Hashlema, the complete land of Israel, without giving up an inch of land, is a key Jewish value, who are we to say, and how do we know that no, Mishpat or Tzedek or Tzedakah actually is stronger than that? Because if what we're going to do is to look at the halachic sources and derive values from those, really, that's a matter of opinion, which one takes precedence over another, isn't it?
You're hitting the problem on totally, right? When you talk about Jewish values, you're not talking about one value, and then the obvious question comes up: what if the values seem to be in conflict? Which are the more important values? And there, I don't even know what basis we work with. I think it's clear, from that what some of our great figures would say, it's pretty clear what the Rambam says, not just in the Mora, but in the Yad, in that last halacha of each sefer, which seems to have a Musa contact. He refers again and again to Tikkun HaMidos and when he says Deos, he means Midos. And ethical behavior being a goal of many of the of most of the mitzvahs, he says. I quoted Rav Kook saying it. I teach different things, the writings of the Rav. He says it in different ways all the time. So to outweigh them, we really need very strong support. And I'm not going to, I don't, we're not here for the debate this issue, but it's strong because I want to be cautious because I don't want to come off only as a critic of everything we're doing. But unfortunately, it's not clear to me at all that, we're focused that much on the ethical issues. And I'll give you a very concrete example, though I suspect it's going to be controversial. Israel prides itself on being a moral army. A lot of this stems from having a unique ethical code for the Israeli army. And you can look it up. It's only 2 pages. It can be read in Hebrew and in English. It was written by Asa Kasher, Rabbi Menachem Kasher's grandson, who's an Orthodox Jew. But he talks about universal morals as part of it. It is the religious community, the religious Zionist community, obviously the Haredi community is not in the picture, who have attacked the ethical code, and this notion of universal morality as really a Western slash Christian morality and not the Jewish one. And unfortunately, in many of the incidents that have come up over the years, where a lot of things are just the mistakes that occur in war, but there are a number of situations where it's been very specific, didn't follow the protocol. Right, the story a number of years ago when the terrorist was on the ground having no, being no threat to anybody, and the soldier just shot him and killed him. This denying the validity of this ethical code is coming specifically to a great degree from the religious community. So it's certainly not creating the impression that this is the focus of the community. I'm not talking about specific behavior by individuals. I'm talking, as what's the important thing. Interestingly, I'm just about finished teaching Kol Dodi Dofeik to some students in NYU who never heard of it, even though everybody from a couple of generations ago certainly knew it very well.
I'll just explain to the listeners, that's Rav Soloveitchik's book from, I believe, 1955 or so,
Yeah.
when he talked about On Yom HaAtzmaut. It was originally a speech, later on became a short book where he talked about the six knocks that God is
Right.
knocking on the door. He also discussed the problem of theodicy, the Shoah, the covenant of fate and destiny, a very, very short but important book.
Okay, I'm sorry. You see, you understand better than I'm that people don't automatically connect to it. The failure of secular Zionism was when we have a state, then it's all over. We don't have to do anything anymore. We're normal again.
We're done.
A normal state, like everybody else's state. That's the failure. By the way, in the World Zionist Organization, I was once involved in a negotiation when there was a religious conflict between Orthodox and Reform in America, but that's important for the World Zionist Organization, which we had to come out with a mutually agreed Jerusalem statement, which I had to sign on to be a Zionist. That had to be something, right? So included in the statement was that it had to be Medina Olam Mofet. Everybody understood it had to be special,
A special state that serves as a positive example to others.
right? A country, right? We want to have a government and a country that's run on a higher ethical stage, on a different level. So it's not just criticizing the secular, though it certainly was not an invalid criticism of the secular. What happened to it? What happened to it? I understand we're very defensive. We're fighting an ugly war against a terrible enemy. But every time an incident occurs, the response is we're not worse than somebody else because 10 years ago, the Americans did it in this, and 20 years ago, someone did it in that. But this driving, no, we're not measuring ourselves. We're as good or as bad as everybody else, which it's harder, but it should be our goal, right? Not to be not worse than everybody else. We stand a certain standard. Now, again, you asked the right question. What Torah value is more than what Torah value? And when you're talking about values, you're really talking about something rather abstract. It's transferable to actions, of course, but it's not as clear. Someone asked me a shayla about what percentage of tzedakah one has to give, and do you give Jewish charities before non-Jewish charities? It's a formula, right? So whether you think there is a formula or you think it's open to interpretation, that's a halachic question. Is there a halachic question is, I want to give it tzedakah. Are there halachic priorities that I should base what I'm doing on? When I talk about the value of giving tzedakah, and I don't put it into a halachic contest, but it's a Torah value, then I can't even begin to think of how do I determine priorities? Whatever appeals to me becomes, which again loses a certain amount of authenticity if everybody can just decide what they want to do.
Let me ask you a question then about that, because something that some people have talked to me about, not just in the context of this particular podcast, but in other things I've talked about in the past, is what some would call natural moral law, this idea that we have our own understanding inherently and innately given to us. Let's call it a subconscious revelation from God, what is good and what is not. Some agree that such a thing exists, some don't, and that's the machloket perhaps of the Rambam and the Ramban, but then we don't have to get into the details now. But the question I have is this. So some people have complained and said that, for example, one thing that Rav Rabinovich Zatzal, or Rav Sachs, echoing him Zatzal, talked about was the fact that in Torah, the Torah has a general anti-slavery message, even though the Torah condones and even sometimes requires you to have certain slaves. Okay, leaving aside the particular arguments of Rav Rabinovich, which I find very compelling myself, but that's not the point. Some people have said they don't like that. They say because he's using non-Jewish morality to read something into the Torah that's not there. I don't think that's true. I think anyone who reads the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim, we're in Nisan now, knows that the Torah has an anti-slavery message inherently. But how do I know when I'm looking for values that the value that I'm espousing is authentically a Torah value and the value that I'm putting lower down or maybe rejecting is not a Torah value? Those same people who say that the ethical code of the IDF is influenced by Christian values, I think that's wrong, but I can't prove that they're wrong either.
Yeah. You've touched on most important point. I think I touched on it before. This notion of university morality can go back to Rav Sacha Gaon, the Mitzvah Sichlios, as well as the Mitzvah Shimios, that you don't have to explain what's ethical, and it's not just the social contract that if everybody killed each other, we can't have a functioning society, so we have to stop it.
Those who would argue it would say that there's something inherent. It's almost a revelation from God.
It's a real question, and I think it's key to the whole discussion that we've been having. Obviously, I share the notion that there is a basic universal morality. And aside from that, all of Sefer Bereishis is about morality and ethics, except for Bris Milah and Gedan Asher. I'm not talking about mitzvahs, the Shiva mitzvahs from Noach, which certainly are meant to be universal. And the fact that it's there and the stories, and we learn from all the stories about the behavior of the Avos and how they interact with people, points very much in that direction. I understand someone can say, look at Rashi, it's all there to talk about our rights to Eretz Yisrael. I can't prove one way or the other. I think it's a very fundamental question. But if we believe that included, I'm also teaching something else from the Rav on Tfilah and on Kriya Shema, that included in the special kavana for Kriya Shema is not just Yediyas Hashem, but Ahavas Hashem, Rahavta, and Talmud Torah. I want to talk about Talmud Torah now, but the second one, and Ahavas Hashem, the Rambam clearly says, involves Kiddush Hashem, Shehem Shem Shema Mis'av, Yedecha.
That refers to the requirement to sanctify the divine name and to make God's name beloved upon people by their seeing that we behave in a moral manner. And they would say, people who behave like this, I want to be like them.
Which doesn't make any sense if we assume that we have values that are not universal and nor else are different from everybody else's values. So why should they impress them? If we have a notion of behavior that goes through the Gemara, you know, and Yoma, of which particular behavior will cause other people to say, you know what, these Jews are really special people. The religious ones, how much more so? And we're mekayim shem shem shemai misava yodecha. But if assuming that our values have nothing to do with the world's values, I'm not sure how we accomplish that. You know, I once
That's a
heard
really good
the
point.
Rav. I know I'm quoting the Rav, and I usually try to be careful because I don't want to quote anything that I can't find in print. I'm not sure I can find this one in print. The Rav once said, in talking about Kiruv, not talking about non-Jews yet at this point, talking about Kiruv, he said, we're not going to be successful in Kiruv by showing the non-observant Jews how well we keep Shabbos or what's our standard of kashrus, because they don't believe in keeping Shabbos or kashrus. But on the areas that they do believe in, if we show that an Orthodox Jew is more moral and more ethical, the values that they can appreciate, then we can accomplish something. Now, again, it's within a certain frame of thinking. And this, all these things are up in the air in Israel at the present time. And to some degree in America, the American Orthodox community is very supportive of Israel, but is not very nuanced. It's not on top of the theological debates or anything else. You know, it's really very, we support Israel, Israel in trouble, Hamas is terrible, we got to support it, period. You know, it's, the rallies revolve, interestingly, a lot on saving the hostages. The OU got 180,000 letters to the President of the United States. You know, you find the gimmick so that the numbers work.
It works.
So the cast, the government to support Israel and to help Israel get a final victory. But the focus was the hostages, right? I didn't want to be negative, but if you would have asked me privately, you're asking President Biden to be the one to determine this, you know, the saving of the hostages. I don't think he's the one making, he's not negotiating behaviors of Israel, no about negotiating Hamas. He's not the one who's going to make that determination. In the Israeli government, which segment of the government, and I don't want to talk about the government in broader terms, which segment of the government thinks saving the hostages should not be a priority?
Well, the Religious Zionist Party, headed by Smotrich, was the party that was explicit
Smotrich
about that.
And Greer, it's the Religious Zionist. The Americans have no idea about that. Getting back to where we started, in Israel, they're working on it. I may think that there's certain risks involved, serious risks in it, but certainly there's a realization that we have to give some different focus to how we see Judaism in the context of having a country and a national existence, even though there's a concept of Tzibur, of course, but essentially, you know, the Jew in Gullus is a private individual. And he doesn't have to see things from a national perspective. And in Israel, they're thinking about it. Trouble is that, you know, the world's going on while we're thinking, you know. We've come to the conclusions yet, and the world doesn't slow down to give us an opportunity.
It's very difficult when Israel is supposed to be, as you say, a Medina Lemofet, an exemplary nation, an Or LeGoyim, a light to the nations, and try to exemplify certain universal values. And I certainly agree with that. The problem sometimes is when everyone is dan lachaf chova, assuming Israel is doing the worst no matter what happens. That's the problem. So even when they are doing something which is on a high level of morality and ethics, they're still treated as if they're doing something improper.
You're right. And survival is certainly a primary value. No one can question Hayecha Kodmin. But I'm talking about a perspective for us. Will it satisfy all the anti-Semites? Obviously not. But I also don't buy in that everybody's an anti-Semite. And most of them are hiding it, right? There obviously are differences. With all how things have gotten worse in the United States, it's simply safer for a Jew in the United States than to be in England. Every country has its own history and its own mix of people, you know, that affect how they deal with it. Oh, I'll give you a very concrete example, a frustrating one, especially since I work in YU. Everybody thought that with the growth of anti-Semitic incidences on the college campuses, and the students feeling threatened, that the number of people transferring out from these secular universities would be substantial.
Right. I was assuming this probably would be YU's biggest year ever, given everything that's happened.
Yeah, but it hasn't happened. It's been isolated cases. It hasn't really happened. You know, I have a couple of sons who function within a high school framework, Yeshiva High School framework. So one of them, not only knowing the school where he works, which happens to be the largest Yeshiva High School in America, you know, so it's a good example. But from other schools, when they announced on April 1st who got in, it was just as excited if they got into Columbia and Penn as they were a year ago. It hasn't fully changed behavior. Anyway, it's very complicated. My point is, we don't owe the world an explanation. We owe ourselves.
I like that very much. I think that's a good place to conclude. Rabbi Blau, you've really made so many, as always, so many important points today. And I appreciate your responding to the podcast. I appreciate the feedback, first of all, and certainly giving me the opportunity to talk with you and hearing the other side of Rabbi Israel's important points and Rav Cook's important points, and to understand that even things that are good ideas, we have to understand the unintended consequences that sometimes accrue to them.
Everything is unanticipated consequences. We've all learned that to our disappointment, that when we get what we want, somehow it turns out not quite as good as we thought it would be.
And it's such an important point now, this idea that Israel has to live up to its own high standards, or maybe sometimes raise its standards so that we don't say, hey, everybody else is doing it. Why are you upset with us? That might be an answer in theory that explains why we're not worse, but we have to be better. I believe that often Israel is the most moral country on earth. And when that happens, we should be happy that we're doing so. And when it doesn't happen, and sometimes we have to acknowledge that it doesn't happen, we need to call it out and say, we deserve better. We should be better. Sometimes I say that the people of Israel deserve to have a state and a government which is as strong as the population is. And I hope that becomes true.
I think a number of people made that observation in the first few days of the war. With such incredible volunteer activity, where unfortunately the government often is still not prepared to cope with the implications of having the people out of their homes and setting up things for them. And the schools were all set up voluntarily, not by the appropriate government agent.
It was set up sometimes in spite of the government.
Yeah, we're better than our governments. But unfortunately, we're a democracy, so we can't hide behind the fact, you know, that the government, what do you mean the government? It's a democracy. You voted for this government. They didn't steal the election.
Rabbi Blau, I appreciate it. Thank you very much for your response.
My pleasure.
Subscribe to The Orthodox Conundrum on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. please visit jewishcoffeehouse.com for other episodes of the Orthodox Conundrum, as well as many other great podcasts, including Intimate Judaism, The Maimonides Minute, Chochmat Nashim, The Francisca Show, and Let My People Eat. I'd appreciate it if you go to Apple Podcasts and rate and review the Orthodox Conundrum. It takes literally 2 minutes. It's just giving a certain number of stars and writing one or two sentences. Please like the Orthodox Conundrum podcast on Facebook and join our growing Facebook group, the Orthodox Conundrum Discussion Group, where you can feel free to discuss issues in Orthodoxy in an honest and friendly environment. I hope you'll become a Jewish Coffeehouse patron on Patreon. Just click on the link in the description of this podcast, and you can get bonus episodes, Jewish Coffeehouse merch, and more. You'll get special episodes on all sorts of topics that are only available to subscribers, and you'll be helping Jewish Coffeehouse spread our message of a welcoming, intellectually engaged, and honest Orthodoxy. Just join Patreon. It's only a couple of dollars a month, and you can stop anytime, so join today. Finally, do you have a message that needs to get out? Do you want to promote your business, your organization, or your cause? The best way is by producing a podcast, and Jewish Coffee House can make it happen. I have experience producing hundreds of podcasts, both for myself and for satisfied clients. Whether you want to learn everything you need in one day, or relax and record and let me do the heavy lifting, Jewish Coffeehouse Productions will work with you to make it happen and make it even better than you imagined. Let me help you today. Write to me at scott@jewishcoffeehouse.com or go to jewishcoffeehouse.com, click on Productions, and sign up for a free consultation. Make your voice heard, promote your cause, sell your product, and engage an audience now. I'm Scott Kahn. This has been the Orthodox Conundrum on jewishcoffeehouse.com.